This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So there's a book that Andy Warhol put out in 1975. It was explaining his philosophy on life. And he had a very simple explanation for why he thought America was a great place. This is what he wrote in the book. In America,
we'll return after these messages.
You can be watching TV and see Coca-Cola.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love.
And you know that the president drinks Coke, that Liz Taylor drinks Coke. And just think, you can drink Coke too. A Coke is a Coke, he wrote. And no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one the bum on the corner is drinking. So here's a question then. Why do we feel that way about Coke, but not Shasta or RC?
You know, we didn't have a ton of money, and like my dad grew up in a house where they drank Royal Crown Cola, so Royal Crown was like always around.
This is filmmaker Morgan Spurlock, and he has thought about this question as well.
Whenever I got to have a Coca-Cola, it was like the greatest thing ever, because it was the Ferrari of sodas. And it's not, I don't know if they taste better, but it's just like, they just taste better.
But why, or why do we think they do? Well, that's our show today. Why Coke has that pull, why we go for Bayer aspirin over generic, why Apple computers make us believe we're creative, why brands have so much power over the brain, and how we assign value to a million different things every single day without barely a thought. So a few years ago, Morgan Spurlock had just shot a documentary called Supersize Me. You might remember it. He ate McDonald's every day for a month. Anyway, sometime after that, he wanted to turn his attention from the food to what makes us want the food. And so he came up with a new film project. How did you decide to make that film, the greatest movie ever sold, Palm Wonderful's greatest movie ever sold?
Palm Wonderful presents the greatest movie ever
right,
sold.
Sorry.
That's the official title. Thank you, Palm Wonderful, for paying for that. No, the whole idea of that film, you know, my producing partner, Jeremy Chilnick, and I for years had talked about making a movie that looked at the world of advertising. And we'd never kind of, we were always like, well, what would our end be? How would we do it differently than someone else? And we had watched an episode of Heroes. And I loved Heroes. But it was like the first episode of the second season, and like Hayden Panettiere, the cheerleader, had moved to a new town.
All the electives I wanted filled up last semester.
Come on, it's your first day. You should be excited.
She was coming out of school, and she was all upset, and you know she was mad because it was her birthday, and she didn't have any friends in the new school, and she was so mad.
I have one friend. I'm shark bait.
Oh, you're going to do fine.
And her dad's like, oh, honey, cheer up.
Your mother and I were going to surprise you on your birthday next month, but...
And he reaches in his pocket, and as he does, the camera cuts to the front of this car, and Dolly's past this Nissan logo, and it cuts back to him holding the keys in front of her face, and like the camera racks focus from the Nissan keys to her face, and then back to the keys, and she smiles, and she goes,
oh my gosh, the Rogue?
The Rogue? You're giving me the Rogue? Oh my God, Dad, the Rogue! I can't believe you're giving me the Nissan Rogue! It's the Rogue!
I know.
And so here in the middle of this show that was so beloved to me was this terrible, awful commercial. And I was just dumbfounded by it. Later on in the show, you know, now she's got friends because of the car and it's great. And she's leaving a party and she's like, come on, guys, to the Rogue. And I was like, oh, come on, that's enough. I was so mad.
So the next day, Morgan called up Jeremy, his producing partner.
And I said, you know what we should do? I said, we should just make a whole movie about product placement where the whole thing's just funded by product placement. And it was like, and at that moment, we just both looked at each other and we were like, that's the idea. That's the film. And so out of that came the greatest movie ever sold.
And within weeks, they started to film the process of making that documentary, first pitching the idea to a bunch of ad execs to see if they were interested. This is a clip from the movie.
Greatest movie ever sold. So what happens in the greatest movie ever sold is that everything from top to bottom, from start to finish, is branded from beginning to end. So maybe we sell a shoe and it becomes the greatest shoe you ever wore. The greatest car you ever drove from the greatest movie ever sold. You know, the greatest drink you've ever had, courtesy of
the. You were like, okay, this shouldn't be a problem. Like, I'll just go to all these companies and say, hey, I promise you I'm going to make a film. It's not going to disparage your brand. And I'm going to, you know, have like little commercials for your brand in the movie.
That's right. We were like, what brand is going to say no to this? This is great.
None of them wanted anything to do with this movie. I mean, I was amazed.
Here's Morgan Spurlock on the TED stage.
They wanted absolutely nothing to do with this project. And I mean, I was blown away because I thought the whole concept, the idea of advertising was to get your product out in front of as many people as possible, to get to as many people to see it as possible. Especially in today's world, this intersection of new media and old media and the fractured media landscape, isn't the idea to get that new buzzworthy delivery vehicle that's going to get that message to the masses? You know, that's what I thought. Now, when I started talking to companies, you know, and telling them, you know, we wanted to tell this story, and they said, no, we want you to tell a story. We want you to tell a story, but we just want to tell our story. See, when I was a kid, and my father would catch me in some sort of a lie, he would say, son, there's three sides to every story. There's your story, there's my story, and there's the real story. Now, you see, with this film, we wanted to tell the real story.
I said, you know what? I'll just cold call the brands myself. And I got on the phone and just started cold calling every CMO that I could get on the phone.
Thanks for calling Target Corporation. We're just unable to participate.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a movie that I'd be excited about going to.
Right. Goes against everything that we do.
From the time we got the idea to the film to when the first brand said yes, it was 9 months of us cold calling brands.
There's this amazing scene in your film that you show on the TED stage where you get a meeting with the executives from BAN, the deodorant company.
We are a smaller brand, much like you talked about being a smaller, you know, movie. Yeah. We're very much a challenger brand, so we don't have.
And then you ask them, you say, so how would you describe the BAN brand?
Yeah.
What are the words that you would use to describe BAN? BAN is blank.
BAN is blank. And then it's literally silence in the room. Nobody says anything. They're all just sitting there. And then, like, the CMO at the time, like the vice president of the company goes,
that's a great question.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's amazing. It was amazing. But here's the incredible thing about BAN deodorant. As soon as BAN said yes, we started calling other brands up. And they'd say, okay, well, who has said yes so far? And I said, well, BAN deodorant said yes. And suddenly there'd be a pause, and the people on the other end would be like, well, but you should come in and meet with us then. If BAN's doing it, then we've got to talk about this. Like, BAN deodorant became the linchpin. And so once they said yes, JetBlue, Palm Wonderful, Hyatt said yes. And then once Hyatt said yes, then it was done.
And then there was a brand that Morgan really wanted as a sponsor, Mane & Tail. They make a shampoo.
But it's not just a shampoo. It is a shampoo that is made for both horses and people. It's true. Because think about how many times have you been in the shower with your horse and said, why can't there be a shampoo for both of us? Now there is. Now we can both have the same shampoo and conditioner. Thank you, Mane & Tail.
So you went to them and you said, look, I'd love to work with you.
And I stalked them. I stalked them for the film. Like every other day, I'm calling the company, leaving a message. Finally, the CEO calls me back and says, so I just want to hear about this. I get it. You're making this product placement film. Sounds funny. So how do you envision our product being in the film? And so I say to him, I say, okay, picture this. We're in the bathroom, and there's a close-up of the bottle of Mane & Tail. And now the camera just starts pulling back. And as the camera pulls back from the bottle of Mane & Tail, you see me washing my little boy's hair. And as the camera keeps pulling back, you see me washing my own hair in the tub. And the camera pulls back further, and as it does, you see me turn to my left as I'm washing my Shetland pony. Silence. There's no response. And then finally he goes, that's the greatest product integration I've ever heard. Ah! It was amazing. And he's like, and then he goes, oh, man. Oh, that's great. I thought you were going to do something weird with the product. No, that's okay.
I recently went on their website, on the Mane & Tail website. And
yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but they are the official shampoo for the Ellen DeGeneres Green Room. Fact. So the thing about the movie is you went into it like being really pissed off about this thing that happened on Heroes.
Yeah.
But then, like, after you went through the process and you met with all these people,
yeah,
and you learned about it, like, what did you think?
Well, I mean, I think that from my standpoint and with what we did, I mean, we were very fortunate because we got brands who basically were willing to come on board and give up kind of their brand equity and kind of like just literally put it in our hands and say, make what you want. But the amazing thing was after the film premiered at Sundance, the lights came up. I came down front, was doing a Q&A, and I invited all the brands that were in the audience to come down front. And people standing ovation. Like people were like, whoa, yes, Band deodorant. Thank you so much. And the best line ever is there was a woman in the front row who said, I want to thank all of you brands for making this movie, for making this film. And I want you to know, I'm going to buy more of your products because of it. She says, she goes, I'm not going to feel good about it, but I'm going to do it.
Over the course of this film, we had 500 plus companies who were up and down companies say no, they didn't want any part of this project. They wanted nothing to do with this film, mainly because they had no control. They would have no control over the final product. But we did get 17 brand partners who were willing to relinquish that control, who wanted to be in business with someone as mindful and as playful as myself, and who ultimately empowered us to tell stories that normally we wouldn't be able to tell, stories that an advertiser would normally never get behind. Today, more than ever, a little honesty is going to go a long way. And that being said, through honesty and transparency, my entire talk, Embrace Transparency, has been brought to you by my good friends at EMC, who for $7,100 bought the naming rights on eBay. EMC, turning big data into big opportunity for organizations all over the world. EMC presents Embrace Transparency. Thank you very much, guys.
Nice one, man. So you sold this to the highest bidder.
It's true.
Here's a question for you. Even though, like, we know that so much of advertising is deceptive, right? I mean, why are we still so seduced by brands?
See, that's the multi-million dollar question. But, you know, and I don't think we're just seduced by brands. I think we're seduced by the imagery that surrounds that brand. It's that these pants are going to make you slimmer. This drink's going to make you hotter. This perfume's going to make you sexier. It's like everything that comes with that brand and the messaging around it. You know, we buy into the dream that surrounds that product much more than we buy into the product. And then once we start using it, we start to believe in the dream of what that product does for us in a lot of ways. You know, I still believe Guinness gives me strength every time I drink a pint.
Morgan Spurlock, he hosts Inside Man on CNN. Check out Morgan's full talk on the TED stage. It's called The Greatest TED Talk Ever Sold. Find it at ted.npr.org. In a moment, the psychology behind why we like certain things. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And today's show, ideas around the power of brand over brain. And why, as we heard a few minutes ago, most of us are completely convinced that Coca-Cola tastes better than RC or the Safeway brand.
And it does. Perrier tastes better than regular water, so long as you know it's Perrier. I think in general, our experiences are modulated not just by our senses, but by our beliefs.
This is Paul Bloom.
I'm a professor of psychology and cognitive science at Yale University.
And a lot of his work is focused on how human beings decide what's valuable and what isn't.
Someone isn't mistaken when they pay extra money for the better known brand because it might lead to extra pleasure.
But how do we decide? I mean, how do we decide what has value?
So you could value things for different reasons. You could value them because of their utility, what they could do for you. You know, so golf clubs, you play golf with them, you know, a suit you could wear. But things get value in other ways as well. And often they get value because of their history. So the golf clubs, if they were owned by John F. Kennedy, would sell for a lot. If the suit is an Armani suit, you might rather have it than if it's from a no-name brand, even if you know consciously that it's the same kind of suit, the same quality. And so we get pleasure from sometimes from knowing what something is and knowing where it came from. and our experience is transformed in that way.
When he spoke on the TED stage, Paul Bloom opened with a story about origins and why they matter.
I'm going to talk today about the pleasures of everyday life, but I want to begin with a story of an unusual and terrible man. This is Hermann Göring. Göring was Hitler's second-in-command in World War II, his designated successor. And like Hitler, Göring fancied himself a collector of art. He went through Europe, through World War II, stealing, extorting, and occasionally buying various paintings for his collection. And what he really wanted was something by Vermeer. Hitler had two of them, and he didn't have any. So he finally found an art dealer, a Dutch art dealer named Han van Meegeren, who sold him a wonderful Vermeer for the cost of what would now be $10 million. And it was his favorite artwork ever. World War II came to an end, and Göring was captured, tried at Nuremberg, and ultimately sentenced to death. Then the Allied forces went through his collections and found the paintings and went after the people who sold it to him and arrested van Meegeren. Van Meegeren was charged with the crime of treason, which is itself punishable by death. 6 weeks into his prison sentence, van Meegeren confessed. But he didn't confess to treason. He said, "I did not sell a great masterpiece to that Nazi. I painted it myself. I'm a forger." And he said, "I'll prove it. Bring me a canvas and some paint, and I will paint a Vermeer much better than I sold that disgusting Nazi. I also need alcohol and morphine, because it's the only way I can work." So they brought him in, he painted a beautiful Vermeer, and then the charges of treason were dropped. He had a lesser charge of forgery, got a year sentence, and died a hero to the Dutch people. But I want to turn now to Göring, who's pictured here being interrogated at Nuremberg. Now, Göring was, by all accounts, a terrible man. Even for a Nazi, he was a terrible man. But you could feel sympathy for the reaction he had when he was told that his favorite painting was actually a forgery. According to his biographer, he looked as if for the first time he had discovered there was evil in the world.
That just says something so amazing about the human mind. No other creature works that way. No other creature cares so much about history and branding and essence.
Yeah. It's like that bourbon, Pappy Van Winkle. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
Yeah, they make like a very limited number of bottles, and it's this very like coveted item. And I had a tiny taste of it once, and you know, it's just some very strong tasting alcohol.
With a great name, Happy Van Winkle.
Pappy Van Winkle.
Happy Van Winkle, yes. Even better,
yeah.
So this is exactly an analogy with art. If there's a single painting, it's of great value. If there's 10, it's less. And if there's 100, it's less. And if there's 1,000, it's less. So in many ways, you can make sense of what happens in the world of consumer products like bourbon by looking at how people respond to art. You could make a consumer product more valuable simply by having it scarce.
Why does this matter? I'm a psychologist. Why do origins matter so much? Why do we respond so much to our knowledge of where something comes from? Well, there's an answer that many people would give. Many sociologists, like Veblen and Wolf, would argue that the reason why we take origins so seriously is because we're snobs, because we're focused on status. I don't doubt that that plays some role. But what I want to convince you today is that there's something else going on. I want to convince you that humans are, to some extent, natural-born essentialists. What I mean by this is we don't just respond to things as we see them or feel them or hear them. Rather, our response is conditioned on our beliefs about what they really are, where they came from, what they're made of, what their hidden nature is.
Isn't it weird a little bit? Like at our core, we're programmed to be like brand snobs.
I think it is weird, but I think it makes more sense when you see it as a byproduct of a more general fact about people, which is that we're essentialists. So for any sort of pleasure, not just consumer items, not just art items, we're obsessed with origin and history. So So seen that way, the effect of brands isn't so strange. It's just a sort of modern consumer manifestation of a more general fact about how our minds work.
Even the most seemingly simple pleasures are affected by our beliefs about hidden essences. So take food. How it tastes to you will depend critically on what you think you're eating. So one demonstration of this was done with young children. How do you make children not just be more likely to eat carrots and drink milk, but to get more pleasure from eating carrots and drinking milk, to think they taste better? It's simple. You tell them they're from McDonald's. They believe McDonald's food is tastier, and it leads them to experience it as tastier. How do you get adults to really enjoy wine? It's very simple. Pour it from an expensive bottle. There are now dozens, perhaps hundreds of studies showing that if you believe you're drinking the expensive stuff, it tastes better to you. This was recently done with a neuroscientific twist. They get people into an fMRI scanner, and while they're lying there through a tube, they get to sip wine. In front of them on a screen is information about the wine. Everybody, of course, drinks exactly the same wine. But if you believe you're drinking expensive stuff, parts of the brain associated with pleasure and reward light up like a Christmas tree. It's not just then you say it's more pleasurable, you say you like it more, you really experience it in a different way.
So what is real doesn't matter? Like, what it's what we believe that matters?
It's impossible to parcel them out. It's clear they both play a role. But the cool finding of research into branding is that we're also powerfully swayed by our belief system. And sometimes our belief system can cause us to take something which would be typically of no value at all and give it value.
Okay, so I recently had the best cup of coffee of my life.
Uh-huh.
And the barista had like a handlebar mustache and I think like a monocle. I mean, I'm making that up. But he's telling me about this single origin bean from Maui and the name of the person who roasted it the day before, and the water he pours over the grounds is like exactly 197 degrees. And he hands me this cup and he says, "This is going to be the best cup of coffee of your life." And you know what?
Yeah.
It was. He was not lying.
He was not lying, but having told you all this, it got you in a state where you're ready to appreciate it.
Yeah.
If it came out of the coffee urn at Alcoholics Anonymous, it may not have tasted quite so good.
Yeah. Even though it was the same exact coffee.
That's right.
What if he served me Folgers crystals, having told me all of that?
Right. So it's a really good question what the limits are of branding and the limits are of our expectations and beliefs. So if someone served you really awful coffee after all of that spiel, I think that we do have sense organs for a reason. And we could say, boy, this is, you know, you really oversold us. This is not that good. But we are, given all that, swayed by our beliefs. And it's not clear to me that this is irrational. In general, you could be wrong about facts about the world. It's harder to say that you're wrong about pleasure.
Yeah.
I was, my wife hurt her back, and I was at Walgreens late last night, and I just to pick up some sort of heating pads, and they had them lined up, and for about $10, they had a Walgreens heating pad, and for $20, they had something which looked exactly the same, and I got the more expensive one because I love her.
Because you love her. Because you would not love her as much if you paid half as much for the same product.
I mean, I've been defending the rationality of pleasure. But look, I'll admit that given that we are creatures that pay attention to things like scarcity and background and so on, this means that we could be fooled. It means we could be tricked. It means you're going to see a lot of irrationality in the market and in our everyday life.
I mean, this happens even to you, the guy who understands this intuitively, intellectually, that we are all being manipulated and manipulating ourselves. I mean, you buy the more expensive heating pad. Like, even you fall victim to this whole thing.
I am a total sucker for these things. If you see me now, I am sort of, I have Apple products all around my body and next to me and everything. And to some extent, I like to tell myself it's an objective assessment of the quality. I like their stuff.
Yeah.
But I won't deny that there's sort of a warm glow associated with that brand for me.
Like, you can be sitting in the coffee shop with your Apple laptop and somebody across the coffee shop may not talk to you, but they know that you're a pretty smart guy and you make good decisions because you've got a Mac AirBook.
I'm a creative sort. I'm not some worker drone with Adele.
No.
No way, not me.
Could you argue that, like, the way we experience things that we perceive to be valuable, is that, like, linked to something that is primal, that goes way back?
I think it is. I think it's linked to basically how our minds have evolved to deal with people. So when you deal with a person, your feelings towards them, how you respond to them, is going to be exquisitely calibrated to what you know about them. And I think intimate human relationships would be impossible if pleasure didn't have this deep nature to it. I mean, consider that we find the faces of people we love to be more attractive.
Yeah.
That seems to make evolutionary sense, and it makes everyday sense. It makes sense because finding something attractive isn't meant to be a cold-blooded analysis of the world. Rather, it tells you who to approach, whose company you want to be with. And so it makes perfect sense that if you believe somebody to be kind, they look better to you. I don't find it crazy that we work that way, and I also don't find it crazy that imagination plays such a role in our pleasures. But the fact is, we live in a market economy. We live in a world where people are struggling against one another to get their products across, and get themselves across. So what we'll do is we'll naturally exploit this. The fact that we're influenced by brands may be irrational, but it comes from a rational source, which is that, for the most part, paying attention to these things matters.
Paul Bloom teaches at Yale. His book on what we like and why is called How Pleasure Works. You can check out his full talk at TED.com. So part of the reason why, say, a Mac AirBook might make you feel creative, or why drinking wine from an expensive bottle makes it taste better, may have to do with something very deliberate, something that isn't really about the product, but about the experience.
You know, the best way to generate demand for any offering today is with an experience so engaging that customers can't help but spend their time with you, and then spend their money as a result by buying your offerings. That's what brands need to do, is create these marketing experiences.
This is Joseph Pine, and he studies consumer experiences, specifically authentic experiences, or should I say what we perceive to be authentic. Because the way to get you to buy something is to make sure it becomes part of your life, like an indispensable part of what you like to do. And Joseph calls it the experience economy.
Now, over the last several years, I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and particularly in the Netherlands. And whenever I talk about the experience economy there, I'm always greeted with one particular question. The question isn't really so much a question as an accusation. And the Dutch, when they usually put it, it always starts with the same two words. You Americans. I say, you Americans, you like your fantasy environments, your fake, your Disneyland experiences. They say, we Dutch, we like real, natural, authentic experiences. So much so as that happened is that I developed a fairly practiced response. I point out that, first of all, you have to understand that there is no such thing as an inauthentic experience. Why? Because the experience happens inside of us. It's our reaction to the events or stage in front of us. So as long as we are in any sense authentic human beings, then every experience we have is authentic. And then I always finish off by talking about the thing that amazes me the most about this question, particularly coming from the Dutch, is that the Netherlands is every bit as manufactured as Disneyland. There isn't a square meter of ground in the entire country that hasn't been reclaimed from the sea or otherwise moved, modified, and manicured to look as if it had always been there. It's the only place you ever go for a walk in the woods and all the trees are lined up in rows.
That's a pretty provocative thing to say to a Dutchman, that his country is as manufactured as Disneyland.
Yep. They always grudgingly admit it, you know. They don't like it, but they grudgingly admit it.
Well, you think
it.
About, like, the cheese town and, like, the tulip fields and the windmills. So, yeah, you know.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I discovered since that TED Talk is they actually have this phrase that God created the world, but the Dutch created the Netherlands, you know. So they know it.
I mean, in your talk, you don't imply that Disneyland is bad because it's fake. In fact, you believe that Disneyland is very authentic, like a really true place, right? Because it is fake.
Yes. Well, because it's a certain type of fake.
Disney World is a fake real or a fake reality.
Right? It's not what it says it is. It's not really the Magic Kingdom. But it is, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. Sorry. But Disney World is wonderfully true to itself, right? Just wonderfully true to itself. When you are there, you are just immersed in this wonderful environment.
Everything is satisfaction, zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay.
They have managed everything to give you a particular set of impressions, which are the impressions that we desire when we go there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going back in time to our own youth. We can forget about everything else that is going on in the world, and they do a wonderful job of creating it. And again, the sense in which they are authentic is that they are true to self. I mean, you go in there knowing that this is Disney, that this is manufactured, that it's made for you, that it's controlled, in fact. But that is what Disney is about.
When people go there, are they thinking about this stuff at all, even unconsciously?
Well, most people are not thinking about it consciously, certainly, but they perceive it at a subliminal level. I always like to describe it as authenticity as a sympathetic vibration. Hmm. That when you have this vibration that goes back between an offering and you, and it matches your identity, right? That the offering says, yeah, that's who I am, that's what I'm about, and therefore I view it as authentic. So you don't often have to think about that. You just feel it.
That's Joseph Pine. When we come back, he'll explain the best and the worst thing that can happen to a brand. Our show today, The Power of Brand Over Brain. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today, ideas around branding and the things we tell ourselves about what's cool and what's not. So we were just hearing from Joseph Pine, who's a business consultant. He says that when you go out into the world to spend money, what matters almost more than anything else is how that experience feels.
What happens when you customize a service? What happens when you design a service that is so appropriate for a particular person? That's exactly what they need at this moment in time. Then you can't help but make them go, wow. You can't help but turn it into a memorable event. You can't help but turn it into an experience. Now, most places that I talk to, when I talk about experience, I talk about theme restaurants and experiential retail and boutique hotels in Las Vegas, the experience capital of the world. And now, with the experience economy, it's about rendering authenticity. Because you have to get your consumers, as business people, to perceive your offerings as authentic. When it comes to being what you say you are, the easiest mistake that companies make is that they advertise things that they are not. Think about any hotel, any airline, any hospital. Right? If you could check into the ads, you'd have a great experience. But unfortunately, you have to experience the actual hotel, airline, and hospital, and then you have that disconnect. Then you have that perception that you are phony. That's why you have companies like Starbucks. I said, you want to know who we are, you have to come experience us. And think about the economic value they have provided by that experience.
So earlier we heard from Paul Bloom about this very same thing, right? About the stories that marketers tell when they sell us a cup of coffee, right? And Starbucks tells a good story.
Yeah, I mean, they do everything to come off as authentic, where you go in there and you can smell the beans. You can actually often hold beans in your hand and feel this, you know, this is real coffee. They work on the colors, you know, and the textures of the place to all evoke the earth, right? It's all browns and greens and so forth. Even the fonts that they use are ones that they want to come off as authentic. They talk to you about where they got the beans, where they're located in the earth. And that is one of the most authentic things that we think of, is things that are in and of the earth itself, right? That's that natural authenticity.
But even though they do all these things, like the Starbucks brand is so ubiquitous, it's everywhere, it's on airplanes, and it's in It's in cafeterias and in the shops. Like, you can't escape it. Even with all that stuff, even with that ubiquity, it's still authentic.
Yeah. Well, in fact, that's exactly the right word for it, because that is their biggest problem. Because ubiquity is the death knell of authenticity. You know, if I can encounter it everywhere, then it really has lost its place. And place is a key thing with authenticity, that we view people, things that have a particular place in the world as being authentic. They're rooted. They're grounded. But if they're ubiquitous, then they lose that rootedness about what they are and in fact, who they are.
I'm thinking about, like, a brand, I don't know, like Nike. Could you argue that it was more authentic in its early years, like in the early 80s, you know, before it became the brand of basketball stars, sure, and baseball stars and huge Nike stores all over the country?
I mean, absolutely. And that points to another reason why ubiquity tends to kill authenticity, because you think about when Nike was young, only a few people knew about it. It was the cognoscenti, if you will, that knew about this brand, knew that they created great shoes. And then as it grows, it becomes known. Everywhere in the world knows about it. So it's always like, you know, the cool kids. Once everybody discovers whatever the cool kids like, then they have to move on to something else.
Let me summarize it for the business people in the audience with three basic rules. One, don't say you're authentic unless you really are authentic. Two, it's easier to be authentic if you don't say you're authentic. And three, if you say you're authentic, you better be authentic. And then for the consumers, for everyone else in the audience, let me simply summarize it by saying, increasingly, what will make us happy is spending our time and our money satisfying the desire for authenticity. Thank you.
Joseph Pine's book on this is called Authenticity: What Consumers Really Want. You can watch his entire TED Talk at ted.npr.org.
Put my phone off, I suppose, and then it's just headphones on. Is it at that point?
So one of the leading minds in the world of branding is Rory Sutherland,
the vice chairman of Ogilvy & Mather in the UK,
which is a huge global ad firm. So I have a question for you, Rory, and this is kind of a personal question, and I hope it doesn't offend you, but
no. Well, probably not.
This is something you have written about before, so it should not take you by surprise.
Oh, fabulous.
How do you wipe your bum?
Sometimes with, I'm intrigued you ask this, sometimes with moist lavatory paper.
Okay, stay with us, please, because you are about to discover why there is a huge vacuum, a huge potential in the toilet paper market.
Mr. Whipple, please don't squeeze the Charmin.
New squeezably soft Charmin bathroom tissue from Procter & Gamble. Take it home and squeeze it.
Okay, so toilet paper has been commercially available since 1857, and despite the creation of the automobile, flight, home electricity, the internet, since then, the technology of toilet paper has stayed essentially the same.
If you look at it rationally, no one will go out in the garden, get their hands dirty, say, repotting a plant, and go in and go, gosh, I've got mud on my hands. Clearly the thing I must do now is rub them very vigorously with dry paper to ensure that they're clean. You'd use water.
Now, the alternative to that, of course, is moist towelettes, also known as wet toilet wipes, which today are quite flushable. The technology is pretty good. But in the U.S. and in some Western countries, moist towelettes command just 3% of the multi-billion dollar toilet paper market. And of the small number of people who buy them, most of them keep them out of sight. Like they're embarrassed. And Rory is constantly asking why.
One thing seems to be that when you buy lavatory paper, when you look at a shelf, you will see, you know, six or seven major brands. They will come in various sizes, double length rolls, standard rolls, packs of four, packs of six, packs of nine. That then dominates your field of view. And then somewhere on the top left, there will be two small packets of the moist variant. Mm. And without any conscious engagement, the brain probably goes, well, clearly the mainstream thing to do is everybody's just using ordinary dry paper, and that's what I should do too. And clearly this strange moist lavatory paper at the top left is just there for sort of strange deviants or people with a medical condition.
Yeah, like you, like why would you use that if there are only two options?
And of course, You can call that irrational, and an economist possibly would. You know, the fact that our valuation of things is massively affected by what other people think of them. On the other hand, the truth of the matter is that value is pretty subjective.
And this is Rory's basic idea, that there is no such thing as objective value, that we view most experiences in life as good or bad based on how they're branded. Here's how Rory explains it from the TED stage.
Here's one example. This is a train which goes from London to Paris. The question was given to a bunch of engineers about 15 years ago. How do we make the journey to Paris better? And they came up with a very good engineering solution, which was to spend £6 billion building completely new tracks from London to the coast and knocking about 40 minutes off a 3.5-hour journey time. Now, call me Mr. Picky, I'm just an ad man, but it strikes me as a slightly unimaginative way of improving a train journey, merely to make it shorter. Now, what is the hedonic opportunity cost of spending £6 billion on a load of railway tracks? Here's my naive advertising man suggestion. What you should in fact do is employ all of the world's top male and female supermodels, pay them to walk the length of the train handing out free Chateau Petrus for the entire duration of the journey. Now, you'll still have about £3 billion left in change, and people will ask for the trains to be slowed down.
I mean, that is a simple solution. I mean, that is essentially rebranding the train.
I think I ended up coining the phrase the hedonic opportunity cost. I mean, my more serious suggestion, by the way, was that they simply spend perhaps 0.1% of that money installing Wi-Fi on the train.
Right.
You'll be pleased to hear, listeners to my original talk, that I think in about a year's time, those Eurostar trains will actually have Wi-Fi installed, finally. So somebody maybe was listening, I don't know. So, you know, it is interesting in that, you know, one technology should sensibly change the metrics that another technology, in this case rail technology, uses. And yet, probably, you know, the rail business, having invested a lot in faster speed, is slow to pick up on that.
How many problems of life can be solved actually by tinkering with perception rather than that tedious, hard-working and messy business of actually trying to change reality? Frederick the Great of Prussia was very, very keen for the Germans to adopt the potato and to eat it, because he realised that if you had two sources of carbohydrate, wheat and potatoes, you get less price volatility in bread and you get a far lower risk of famine because you actually had two crops to fall back on, not one. The only problem is potatoes, if you think about it, look pretty disgusting. And also, 18th century Prussians ate very, very few vegetables. He tried making it compulsory. The Prussian peasantry said, we can't even get the dogs to eat these damn things. They're absolutely disgusting, they're good for nothing. There are even records of people being executed for refusing to grow potatoes. So he tried plan B. He tried the marketing solution, which is he declared the potato was a royal vegetable and none but the royal family could consume it. And he planted it in a royal potato patch with guards who had instructions to guard over it night and day, but with secret instructions not to guard it very well. Now, 18th century peasants know there's one pretty safe rule in life, which is if something's worth guarding, it's worth stealing. Before long, there was a massive underground potato-growing operation in Germany. What he'd effectively done is he'd rebranded the potato. It was an absolute masterpiece.
Is value just like, is it a construct? Is it something totally invented?
The one thing I would say is that in some cases, things that are bad can also be presented in and framed in such a way that people actually perceive them as good. But an extraordinary finding I saw recently was that merely rebranding Germans who are unemployed as retired. In other words, when unemployed bricklayers, say, in Germany, reach the age of retirement, simply because they were now retired bricklayers rather than unemployed bricklayers, they enjoyed a sudden and quite spectacular increase in happiness, which was equivalent, actually, to the boost in happiness found among newlyweds.
Wow.
Now, nothing really about their material situation had changed. They weren't richer than before. They weren't working before and they weren't working afterwards. But the reframing of unemployment as retirement completely changed their actual level of well-being. But the upper middle class British do exactly the same thing with their own children. If their own children can't get a job, they rebrand unemployment as travelling. I think there's a similar case where Lufthansa were increasingly baffled because although practically everywhere on Earth, orange juice is much more popular than tomato juice, in an airline lounge or on an aircraft... now, this may partly be the Bloody Mary effect, that well-known behavioural science finding. But actually, tomato juice is actually out-consumes orange juice. You know, our preferences are highly contextually set.
How you frame things really matters. Do you call it the bailout of Greece or the bailout of a load of stupid banks which lent to Greece? Because they are actually the same thing. What you call them actually affects how you react to them, viscerally and morally. I think psychological value is great, to be absolutely honest. One of my great friends, a professor called Nick Chater, who is the professor of decision sciences in London, believes that we should spend far less time looking into humanity's hidden depths and spend much more time exploring the hidden shallows. I think that's true, actually. I think impressions have an insane effect on what we think and what we do. I propose that we can use psychology to solve problems that we didn't even realize were problems at all. This is my suggestion for getting people to finish their course of antibiotics. Don't give them 24 white pills, give them 18 white pills and 6 blue ones, and tell them to take the white pills first and then take the blue ones. It's called chunking. The likelihood that people will get to the end is much greater when there is a milestone somewhere in the middle. One of the great mistakes, I think, of economics is it fails to understand that what something is, whether it's retirement, unemployment, cost, is a function not only of its amount, but also its meaning.
So, I mean, isn't so much of this about, I don't know, like trickery? It's like almost like a form of deception to get us to believe in these things.
Well, my argument would be, first of all, it's interesting to see how doctors are generally uncomfortable with the placebo effect because they regard it as cheating. We must actually get people better through, you know, objective chemical means. The idea of actually tweaking their environment or changing their mental state to enable them to get better that way, that's not fair. And yet the placebo effect is patently pretty valuable.
Yeah.
And it is very interesting because advertising, of course, has always come up against this kind of attack, that this is manipulative, in a sense, that even though we don't perceive the world objectively and indeed cannot do so, nonetheless, you must design products and experiences for people as though they were objective. And my question is, well, maybe not.
Now, if you had a large red button of this kind on the wall of your home and every time you pressed it, it saved $50 for you or put $50 into your pension, you would save a lot more. The reason is that the interface fundamentally determines the behaviour. OK? Now, marketing has done a very, very good job of creating opportunities for impulse buying. We've never created the opportunity for impulse saving. If you did this, more people would save more. It's simply a question of changing the interface by which people make decisions, and the very nature of the decisions changes. Obviously, I don't want people to do this, because as an advertising man, I tend to regard saving as just consumerism needlessly postponed. But if anybody did want to do that, that's the kind of thing we need to be thinking about, actually. Fundamental opportunities to change human behaviour. Two quotations to more or less end with. One of them is poetry is when you make new things familiar and familiar things new, which isn't a bad definition of what our job is, to help people appreciate what is unfamiliar, but also to gain a greater appreciation and place a far higher value on those things which are already existing. The second one is the second G.K. Chesterton quote of the session, which is we're perishing for want of wonder, not for want of wonders, which I think for anybody involved in technology is perfectly true. And a final thing, when you place a value on things like health, love, sex, and other things, and learn to place a material value on what you've previously discounted for being merely intangible, a thing not seen, you realise you're much, much wealthier than you ever imagined. So thank you very much indeed.
That's Rory Sutherland. He's given three incredibly entertaining TED Talks all about branding, rebranding, and perspective. You can find all of them at TED.com.
I find myself staring at the shelf with 100 boxes and I need some help. They all look the same, but each seem to claim that they're better than the other one. And I'm sick and thought I don't need another answer to a phony problem. Cause everywhere I go, everything I see, everything is sold to me.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show on branding this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Rund Abdel Fattah, Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Yeah.